You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. John Williams here, Pete Zimmerman there. He's our producer. We appreciate you dialing us in. So everybody hears about inflation, but is it impacting your wallet? And if so, what can you do about it? Federal Reserve and economy reporter at Bankrate, that's Bankrate.com, Sarah Foster joins us. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air. How are you today?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
I think that, as I said just a second ago, we all hear about inflation, but maybe it sneaks up on you, you know. The stories at the same time that we hear about people being worried about inflation, we hear people have a lot of cash and they're anxious to spend it, and they are spending it. So maybe they don't notice. Maybe the impact doesn't feel that real yet. What's your read on that?
Absolutely. Well, I think a lot of financial planners and economists that I talk with like to compare inflation really to oxygen. It's something that's kind of always there and lingering on the sidelines and in the background, but you don't really typically notice it until you start to have bouts like what we're experiencing right now, which is where prices are rising. And I think, you know, inflation definitely has a nasty reputation, especially for those who remember what happened during the 1970s and 80s when it rose to as high as 15%. But the most important thing to remember here is that not all inflation is wallet harming. And of course, what we're seeing right now is the ultimate question, which is how long will these price increases last?
Did you say not all inflation is wallet harming? How could it not be?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the U.S., and they're in charge with keeping inflation in check, they like to see it as this Goldilocks rate, which is where we want a little bit of inflation to guard against something called deflation, which is where the dollars in your wallet don't necessarily go as far as they used to. But this Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold rate of inflation allows the economy to kind of slowly and stably grow. And it gives businesses really the opportunity to slowly raise wages. And I think, you know, for the past 4 decades, wage growth has remained fairly stagnant. So something like what's happening right now might be a good thing, especially for American workers.
Yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it? One man's inflation is another man's raise, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can think about inflation as really the wallet harming kind is really this pay cut. But when the economy is growing along with it and it's low and stable, it really translates to higher earnings.
Still, it is inevitable. That is, at least our listeners tell us when we do bring it up, hey, I noticed that the can of soup that was 89 cents is now 95 cents, and some of it is more dramatic than that. Your piece, here's three ways to protect your wallet from taking a big hit. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, well, I think this really kind of gets back to the ultimate question, which is how do we define inflation? And especially if you're someone who's going to the grocery store seeing higher prices or even going to the gas pump and seeing that, you know, the price that you're paying there is more expensive, it's a little bit hard to really be talking about really how a little bit of inflation is a good thing. But across the board, I think economists like to say inflation really does relate to higher prices in all corners of the economy. And it's not necessarily something that happens overnight. So, you know, that volatility that we see in food and energy prices can be a little bit different than the inflation that we think about as in the kind that really harmed the economy 40 years ago.
But you're saying, like, all right, so if one of your tips, if I'm not mistaken, is kind of do nothing. That is, don't change your mix in your investments.
Yeah, and I think this is really, we kind of think about it here as, and you don't really want to change your strategy all that much based on the direction of where the wind is blowing here. And I think what this means here is that if you're an investor and you're someone who's really in it for the long haul, you're going to be living through periods of high inflation and periods of low inflation. But what this still means is that it's important to really make sure that you have a diversified portfolio, which not necessarily putting all of your eggs in one basket, because diversification is really tends to be the best inflation hedge.
There's three in your article, and the third one we've also kind of covered. That is wallet harming. Don't overreact. It's a natural or maybe not even necessarily bad thing as long as it doesn't run away. But number two on your list, we'll just mention here as well, is save for poor economic conditions, consumers, but don't keep too much cash on the sidelines. I think people are frustrated these days. Well, if they're putting money in the markets, that's great. Everybody seems to generally be doing well. But we wish we had some place to park our money that was just as, it was more secure, was safer, wasn't a gamble. And there doesn't seem to be any place to go other than the markets these days.
Yeah, well, I think when we talk about really saving for poor economic conditions, what you really want to be doing is making sure that you're parking your cash in something like a savings account, which is FDIC insured, is liquid and accessible, something that if you have an emergency, which is kind of what we talk about being prepared for here at Bankrate, something that you can tap into. And I think it seems a little counterintuitive to really be talking about how important it is to save during high inflationary environments just because of what we were talking about earlier, which is it eats away at your purchasing power. But it's also really important to remember here that during periods of high inflation, there's a lot of economic uncertainty, and you want to be prepared for that.
Do you have a number in mind, a percentage or an amount of money people should have on the sidelines that way?
Yeah, well, lots of financial planners like to say that you should be prepared to cover at least 6 to 9 months worth of expenses with a savings account. I mean, that's really something that it takes a while to build up, but a little bit goes a long way.
Number I saw last week, I think, was 2 months. I think most of us or a high percentage of people are, they can make 2 mortgage payments. They can pay 2 electric bills. After that, they can't. 6 to 9 months sounds like a good goal. It's nice to talk to you today, Sarah Foster, Federal Reserve and economics reporter at Bankrate.com. Sarah, we'll visit again. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dennis Rodkin joins us now on WGN on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the residential real estate reporter at Cranes. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. How are you?
I don't know if they're doing that in other stores, but it was nice to see them handing out samples.
You know, there are so many things that are coming back. I haven't seen the samples, but it's just nice to be out and see so many people on the street sit inside a restaurant.
I remember when maybe January, February, saying, oh, will we be ready? Will we be willing? Oh, hell yeah, we are. People are out, man.
Yeah, I'm ready and I'm willing, that's for sure.
Let's talk about the housing market in Chicago. Folks are ready and willing to go out and pay money. Are the premium prices still being paid for real estate around here?
Yeah, you know, for the most part, in the city of Chicago, virtually everywhere you look, single-family homes sell for, on average, for more than the asking price. We've seen prices run up since August, when the buying for new pandemic lifestyle homes began. We have continued to see home prices rise from then till now, and it does not appear to be slowing down anytime soon.
Can you talk a little bit about where or what kind of homes? I mean, my recollection was last year it was people exiting the city, right? They wanted more space. They wanted to work from home. They're going to live from home now. So it was not so good in the city. Is it improved, or how is it doing in the city of Chicago?
You know, it was not so good in the downtown neighborhoods. The neighborhoods that touched the loop, the necklace right there, was hard hit. But really, as the farther out you got from the center of the city, the better off it was. The heavy single-family home neighborhoods, Edison Park, Beverly, those kinds of places, they were doing just as well. There was sort of an easy story for people to tell that everybody was fleeing the city for the suburbs. But really what was going on was there was an extreme lack of demand downtown, but there was a huge demand right outside downtown and all the way out into the suburbs. For two reasons, many people were trading to a space that fit their pandemic lifestyle better. It's bigger. It has more spaces that we can use as home office, classroom, et cetera. It has outdoor space. I might have had a condo with just a balcony, and my kids were going bananas and needed to be able to play in the backyard. But again, I can get that in Edison Park. I don't have to go all the way out into the suburbs. And the other thing that was fueling it, that continues to fuel it, is these very, very low interest rates. It makes it possible for me to do that trade up at a very inexpensive cost.
You compared it in a recent piece, though, to Phoenix and San Diego, which are even hotter markets than Chicago, right?
They are dramatically hotter. Yeah. In March, according to the Case-Shiller Index, home prices were up 19% and 20% in those cities, Phoenix and San Diego, and 9% here. 9% is a lot for us. We haven't seen 9% increases in the Case-Shiller Index, which is a national tracker of home values, in years. We were, just before the pandemic, January 2020, around in there, we were seeing 1% price increases year over year. Now we're at 9%, but nationally it's at 13%. And as we said, in San Diego, it's 19%. In Phoenix, it's 20%. Those places look like they are inflating bubbles right now, or have been for several months. We look a lot safer. We look conservative by comparison.
You know what I thought would happen, though, in Chicago, maybe in the Loop or the Necklace, as you described it a moment ago, people wouldn't want to buy in those neighborhoods because of the violence. I wonder if that's South Loop or other parts of the city. Are you seeing anything along those lines?
We did. In December, I've done several stories, but there was one in December where we saw that while the inventory of properties on the market in Chicago in general was in the 2 or 3 months range, which is to say there's enough on the market to fuel sales for about 2 or 3 months, and healthy is 4 to 6 months, there was about 20 months of inventory on the market in some of those downtown neighborhoods in the Loop, Streeterville, those kinds of places. It's been burning off, partly because a lot of people have just taken their properties off the market. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of a turn. I'm investigating that right now for a story. I think we're starting to see prices have come down so much and reopening is happening that people are starting to say, oh, that's a great confluence. Yeah. Low prices, very desirable place. And I think we might see more demand start to pop in those neighborhoods.
I think that's Lori Lightfoot's real conundrum. I mean, what can you do about a pandemic? But you are in charge of the police. You, as they say, you wear the jacket for some of that. And that is something that we need to, as a city, continue to tend to. Do you know what the amount of time that a house is on the market? How long does it take people in Bolingbrook or in Northbrook or Chicago to sell their home these days?
Oh, yeah, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, John, but generally in almost any city neighborhood outside downtown or the suburbs, they're selling at about half the pace of what they were prior to the pandemic. We're seeing individual homes sell in a few days, but the averages are in the 30 to 60 day range, while downtown, yeah, it's 2 or 3 times that.
But I'm glad you said that, too, because I know somebody who's trying to sell their house and they're a little discouraged right now because the house has been on the market for a week and the house hasn't sold.
And a couple of years ago, it would have been on the market for 9 months. Yeah.
And if 30 to 60 or, you know, if 30 days is a good average, well, then hello, you know, relax. And as David Hochberg said, no, pardon me, as David Hochberg yelled into the radio this weekend, if your house isn't selling, then your house is priced wrong. You know, and you can't change the location. You can change the condition and you can change the price. If your house doesn't sell, then you got to change the condition, paint it, or you've got to lower the price. Those are variables you do control.
This is exactly what I said on our podcast last week. I got a similar question. Somebody said, are sales down because my house has been sitting on the market? And no, sales aren't down. We actually, in the 2 weeks prior, there have been more than 5,100 homes put under contract in each of the past 2 weeks.
Wow.
And during the pandemic, so during the big run-up, it had been running in the 4,500 range. So we're like in the boom on top of the boom right now in the late spring of 2021. So if your house isn't selling, yes, it probably is a function of price. It's probably, so I think you and I have talked about this on the air once before, John. If you bought your house for $1 and you put 20 cents into renovations, that doesn't mean you can sell it for $1.25. You may still sell it for $1.05. It's what the market will pay for it, not the amount you have in it. And that was a very hard lesson for a lot of sellers in suburban areas to learn in the years before the pandemic. And I think now that lesson is being learned by people who have downtown condos. You may have put in a fabulous kitchen. You may have done all sorts of great upgrades and you have incredible style, but the market is still going to pay what the market is going to pay, no matter what you have in it.
Dennis Rodkin is a residential real estate expert and reporter at Crain's, ChicagoBusiness.com. Nice to talk to you, Dennis. It's always good to hear your voice. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, John. See you again.
Joining us once again, Catherine Davis. Pardon me, I just dropped my sheet of paper. Associate editor at Chicago Inno. Hey, Catherine, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I'm doing better than it sounds. Let's start talking about this payment startup TIV. What is that all about?
Yeah, the startup is called TIV, and they're a new local company that just raised $3.5 million last week for their new payment product for people that love playing video games. So the best way to think about them is a banking platform that provides debit and credit card options, and these accounts will link directly with your PC game or on your console, like an Xbox or PlayStation. And users can earn points for every hour that they spend gaming. And those points translate into rewards that they can redeem for cash, other games, and other sorts of monetary rewards. So it's a really interesting concept, but, you know, I think this startup is sort of seeing the surge in the amount of people playing video games over the pandemic. And finding a way to make those hours spent a little more productive.
But if I am rewarded monetarily for playing the video games, who's putting the money up? The video game manufacturers? I mean, how does anybody make money on this?
Yeah, so, you know, TIV is operating like a normal bank would, in the sense that they are charging you credit card fees and other account-related fees. And, you know, usually the way these apps work is that they partner with certain, third-party companies to provide the rewards. But, you know, TIV's business model is just like really any other bank charging people credit card fees.
Let's talk about this startup that helps you buy properties to list on Airbnb. In fact, that won the New Venture Challenge at the U, right?
Yeah, that's right. The New Venture Challenge takes place every year at the University of Chicago. It's a day-long competition where dozens of student startups pitch. And this year, they were competing for $1.6 million, which is pretty incredible if you think about it, that a college can provide that kind of capital to student entrepreneurs. But that's what University of Chicago is able to offer people. And the team that took home the first place prize and about $665,000 is a company called Andy's STR. And they basically make a platform that makes it easier to buy real estate that's intended to only be used for short-term rentals. So if you wanted to buy, you know, a beachfront condominium in Florida and turn it into an Airbnb, this is a platform that makes that process really easy.
Hmm. I'm intrigued. I hadn't thought about that, but I'm also thinking that that's such a popular thing, Airbnbs, et cetera, especially these days, that I'm surprised somebody hadn't already come up with something like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. A business like this can only exist, with other startup or tech type companies, right? Like something like this wouldn't exist if it weren't for Airbnb. But, you know, I think more people are sort of seeing the opportunity to make money in managing short-term rentals. And if you have the capital to do so, it could be a good investment. And Andy's STR wants to help you make that purchase.
Do you know, Catherine, when they win these competitions, are they obligated? I'll say it that way. Are they obligated to then follow through with the company, or can they just collect the cash prize?
So I do believe that in the New Venture Challenge, this is equity-based investment. So, you know, the idea here is the investors will be looking for a return one day. So I think that the founders need to stick with it to the best that they can.
And then just I want to mention, I've talked to some of these people before, and it's just amazing how innovative and smart they are, these students. There is also Phlaxis, if I'm saying that right, Phlaxis, a biotech startup making peanut butter and food allergy vaccines. They came in second place and won over $250,000, right?
Yes, that's right. This is actually a company that I really want to follow up on. You know, I didn't dig too much into them because they came in second place, but that's a really interesting concept. And, you know, if you could really make a vaccine for peanut butter allergies,
yeah.
I mean, that's a huge market.
I mean, think about that.
You change a lot of lives, too.
If you came up with a vaccine for food allergies and you get second place.
Right.
Maybe that says something about how far they have to go with their idea. Vetted, according to your reporting at Biz Journal, a pet insurance product came in third place and won $198,000. Those are compelling purses, I will say that. Let's talk about this Chicago healthcare communications startup. And again, it's one I've not, I don't know this one, Odeza, O-D-E-Z-A.
Yes, Odeza. So this is a local company. They basically make, communication software for the healthcare industry. They simplify and automate patient needs, so they make it easier for patients to schedule appointments with their doctor and track payments and co-pays and those sorts of things. And we wrote about the company last week because they were acquired by a Cincinnati company called Ensemble Health Partners. Terms of the deal were not disclosed, so we're not sure, how the founders and investors, what kind of payday they receive. But this is a pretty early stage company. It was just founded in 2016, and it raised less than $2 million in venture capital financing, which is sort of rare in the startup world. You usually see companies getting acquired after they've raised millions and millions of dollars. So. It's a cool story. They just had about 30 people, so a small startup getting acquired in Chicago.
Catherine Davis is the associate editor at Chicago Inno. Thanks for your help today, Catherine. We'll visit again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
1244. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. The business news continues now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A consortium of three private equity firms has reached a deal worth about $34 billion to acquire Medline Industries, the medical supply and equipment company based in Northfield. Blackstone Group, Carlyle Group, and Hellman and Friedman beat out a rival bid from Brookfield Asset Management. According to reports, it'll be one of the biggest leverage buyouts of all time. Chicago's tech hub, M-Hub, is launching an accelerator program for medical device startups. M-Hub says it's looking for startups that have the potential to transform healthcare. Chicago Inno reports the program will start in the fourth quarter, with the application process starting this summer. This is the second M-Hub accelerator. Earlier this year, they launched one for smart manufacturing startups. M-Hub will eventually launch six accelerator programs. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. I suspect some of our bodies are a little sore after a weekend of trying to grow our own food. Sore muscles are one thing, but gardening and yard work send over 300,000 people to ERs each year. Cuts, broken bones, severed fingers and toes. It isn't just newbies who get into trouble. My very independent grandma was in her 80s when she was mowing her lawn. The grass got clogged in the chute. She stuck her hand down to free it and lost parts of a few fingers.
Oh, gosh.
That groan is from our gardening guru, Jim Fazell, who has seen too many people who should know better losing body parts or being injured in other ways while doing yard work.
Safety is a state of mind. You need to think before you act. I know too many people have gotten themselves in trouble, and you and I have talked about this, where they did something not thinking about it and ended up with a serious problem.
Like my grandma.
Yeah. Let's talk about power equipment. Make sure before you use it, you know how to use it. The moving blades, the impellers, make sure that guards are left on because they're there to keep you from getting into these things. Before you use the power mower, go out and remove the projectiles that may be out there, rocks and so forth that you could hit with those blades and send those things flying. And wear appropriate clothing, not loose stuff, and sturdy shoes if you're going to mow. Tools, sharpen them before you use them because it's a lot safer to use a sharp tool than it is a dull one. It takes less effort and you're less likely to strain a muscle. Buy good tools of the right size for you. Keep them in good shape. Repair and replace them as needed. And enjoy yourself outdoors. We should have a wonderful summer, and we need to be in a condition to enjoy it and not to get ourselves in trouble before we can.
Yeah, Mr. Fizz. At the Chicago Board of Trade, it was a wild week last week. Looks like it's going to be a wild this week, too. Soybeans are down about 14 cents. Corn's down a nickel, and wheat is trading down about a nickel as well. Today is National Chocolate Ice Cream Day. No, chocolate milk and ice cream do not come from brown cows. A survey shows 7% of us believe that. Come on, people. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk with Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch about something that Steve Alexander and I talked a little bit about earlier today, and that is the FDA approving this Alzheimer's drug. How about that?
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. And what's really notable about it is that this is the first new drug for Alzheimer's disease that's been approved in nearly 20 years. There is some controversy around it. There's a warning from an independent advisor that this much debated treatment really hasn't been shown to help slow the disease, but the FDA says that it feels that it will reduce the clumps of plaque in the brain, and therefore that is expected. That's their words, is expected to help slow dementia. I think it's fascinating. It certainly will be perhaps a hopeful note to a lot of people who have someone in their family impacted by this. But we'll see. It is unlikely that it would be pulled from the market, but under the terms of the approval, the FDA is requiring the drug maker to do a follow-up study to confirm the benefits, just because of how much kind of controversy has been around it. So we shall see. We will keep an eye on this, but I think it's a very interesting news. The company Biogen did not immediately disclose the price. The drug is called Aduhelm, and they didn't say exactly what the price would be, but some industry analysts and some industry watchers said that they expect the drug would be about $30,000 to $50,000 for about a year of treatment. So not inexpensive, but we'll see what this becomes.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I think on the one hand you say, well, what's the harm? Let's give it a try. And we sort of have that attitude with the rush to a successful COVID vaccine. What's the harm? Let's give it a try. But it's going to be hard to put this genie back in the bottle. And if they're making $30,000 to $50,000 per patient per year, and people are hoping that it slows the progress of Alzheimer's, which is kind of hard to gauge anyway, the concern I have, and that I understand other people have, is that this company is going to be making money, maybe not doing as much good for people as is promised. That's the conundrum right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And really, the critics of it are, it's less about, hey, this isn't proven because it's been through some clinical trials. The criticism of it is that it's unclear whether or not it slows the progression. So there's not like some big looming side effect, something like that. But I think that's the big question that we have to wait and see. Does this, in fact, slow the progression of the disease as it's promised, rather than managing symptoms like a lot of the drugs on the market related to Alzheimer's do? They treat the anxiety or the insomnia or, restlessness, things like that. So we shall see about this one. But I have the same questions that you do, and I'll be watching that closely.
Genetically modified salmon. Catch me up on this.
Yeah, who knew that was a thing? Well, it is a thing indeed. I feel like this is kind of a Steve Alexander story, but nonetheless, the first harvest of genetically modified salmon started this week. It was a little bit delayed by the pandemic, but it has been cleared for human food in the U.S. And essentially what these salmon, the way they're modified is that instead of taking about 36 months to reach full size and be harvested, they take about 18 months. So it kind of cuts the time in half to prepare the salmon for people's dinner plates. And so they're going to be working on away from home kind of dining services and restaurants where labeling for genetically modified food is not required in the same way as it is on grocery store shelves. So there are plenty of grocery companies that said, if and when we cross that bridge, it would be labeled. Costco is one of them. So that would definitely be labeled if that was going to be on our shelves. Kroger, Walmart, and Whole Foods also said they don't sell anything genetically modified or cloned, and they would have to label that. So interesting, though. It's kind of a fascinating thing to kind of dig through the research and dig through how they did this and how they created the salmon that essentially reaches adulthood in about half the time than we're used to.
Yeah, that seems modified, but I don't know that I care. If it's okay to eat, I wonder if I care. If it's delicious, I'm curious to see a price comparison too down the road.
Yeah, and there is a boycott that I should say against this salmon. It's made by Aqua Bounty, And it's mostly coming from activists that are trying to protect wild salmon and make sure this genetically modified salmon, that they don't get into the wild salmon gene pool, and also to preserve the indigenous rights to practice sustainable fishing kind of practices. So, you know, we all say, you know, what could happen? But then, you know, one of these salmon gets out in the river or something, and suddenly we have who knows what kind of, you know, thing going on. But it seems like the origin story of a superhero, though.
Let's spend some time next week or later this week and talk about Jeff Bezos. He's going up on his rocket in July, huh?
He is. And he said he wanted to be among the first. He said this is a very big deal. He's going to go up in the in this rocket from, you know, from his own company, the Blue Origin flight scheduled in July. It's not going to be a huge flight. It's going to take off from Texas and pretty much come right back down. But he will be joining that crew. It's going to be July 20th, which is also the anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Wow. Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks again, Amy.
Thanks, John.